Investors Chronicle.
Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. It's Thursday, the 10th of August, as we record here, as usual, in the studio at Financial Times HQ. Today is the 126th anniversary of the founding of the RAC. So to mark the occasion, sort of, we're going to be discussing latest figures from auto parts maker TI Fluid Systems. Then we'll move on to our cover story this week. With quote-unquote risk-free rates having risen over the past year, we are discussing the different options available to income seekers. And we're also looking at some of the big do's and don'ts for managing a smaller portfolio in our final segment. Whether you are a new investor with a small amount of money on your hands, whether you're someone tasked with managing a separate pot for a family member, or whether you're doing something else entirely that I haven't thought of, we will be discussing all those aspects from the point of view of smaller portfolios later in the show. Joining me to discuss all of this are, over the line, Mark Robinson, and in the studio, Val Cipriani. Hi, Val.
Hi, Dan.
And Dave Baxter.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, everyone. Right, so we'll start, Mark, with you. You wrote up the figures, the interim figures for TI Fluid Systems, the auto parts maker, a few days ago. I suppose we should give readers just a brief overview of the company. I think it's fair to say, have two divisions, don't they, doing respectively brake and fuel lines, so a bit more kind of EV focused, that one, and then fuel tank and delivery systems in the other half of the business, which is a bit more focused on, you know, traditional vehicles as per the fuel tank designation. But how did the figures look to you?
It was a sort of a mixed bag, really, but they were broadly favorable, I'd say. What stuck out to me was there were the operational efficiencies through the period under review there. They've been helped along slightly by the fact that the Chinese economy has reopened. And so they sell into a lot of original equipment manufacturers in the People's Republic. And they've just been going through their order backlogs and inventory restocking. The benefits of that will probably be perhaps even more apparent over the second half of the year as well. So that's favorable for shareholders. Revenues grew at 15%, and the company managed to boost the adjusted trading margin as well by a fairly hefty 210 basis points. This was partly due to the success they've had in clawing back some of the inflationary cost pressures during the period. That led to a net benefit of 130 basis points, and the company themselves highlighted the challenges due to wage price inflation too. And we don't really know if that's going to moderate over the second half of the year, but I think they're well prepared to keep on clawing those prices back, particularly as demand from China is going to ratchet up a bit now that the economy's reopened.
Yeah, they have a medium-term target of double-digit margins. So this is clearly, you know, a step along the way there.
Yeah.
If we look at the two halves of the business, though, and that kind of split, obviously they're benefiting from, it looked to me, you know, fairly strong growth in the FCS division, as it's called, which is the fluid storage and the brake lines, that side of things, as more, you know, EVs gain market penetration. Equally, though, the other side of the business has been holding up as well. I mean, do we expect kind of a big shift towards the former over the latter?
I tend to think it will be more incremental. It rather depends on which area they're selling into as well. Adoption rates in China are certainly more favorable than the United States of America, and the same applies for Europe too. I think the increased focus on the brake lines part of the business was inevitable, as is the increased focus on the Chinese market too, because I was looking at some data from Global Data earlier on today, and the forecast for global light vehicle output this year is about 5% higher than last year. But of course, the salient detail is that China is going to account for anywhere between 26 and 30% of total production. That output stalled a little bit over the last 18 months or so for obvious reasons linked to their stringent COVID-19 policies. And you look as well, the awards that have been given over to the company in the terms of BEV, battery electric vehicles, over the period or on the lifetime basis, stand at about 640 million euros. And about 45% of that figure is related to the Chinese market and their original equipment manufacturers too. So obviously they're selling into those, they get rebranded. And, you know, it's a sort of an entrenched business model too, which is highly favorable. So they're planning to open, or they confirm they're going to open up an e-mobility innovation center in China this year too. So, I mean, the sort of die is cast there, really. But I think it will tend to be more incremental than a wholesale shift.
Yeah. What are the, you know, there's a big opportunity there, clearly, in China. I think, you know, in the first half of this year, it became the world's biggest car exporter as well because of its proficiency in battery electric vehicles. But there are risks as well, presumably, for a business. You know, clearly, it's entrenched, as you say, but equally, you know, there are a lot of Chinese businesses involved in this kind of, well, you know, in the supply chain as well. I don't know how many of them are competitors to TI Fluid Systems, but when you're dealing with, you know, a market like that, there's got to be some risks to, you know, it's a high risk, high reward potentially.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's certain issues. I mean, there was a lot of talk this year about China flooding Western markets with sort of cut price electric vehicles, and certainly the production costs are much lower in the People's Republic. There are inherent risks dealing over there. I mean, you know, intellectual property theft readily springs to mind. Now, whether that's likely to affect TI is debatable or not. But looking at what's happened over the last year as well, I should have mentioned that both segments recorded similar rates of cash profit growth during the period. Although the fluid carrying systems division, you know, they grew revenues at a much higher rate. So, I mean, I'm just extrapolating upon this. I tend to think that margins may improve in that corner of the business more rapidly over time as well, because obviously it's in its development phase, even though it's established in China. And you would imagine that economies of scale will start to kick in as we move forward.
Yeah, I think they addressed some of this on the analyst call, actually, talking about those margins. It seems fair that, you know, that is the volume game ultimately. Maybe to begin with, there's going to be lower volumes at the beginning and, you know, as they start to penetrate their market a bit more. But I think the other interesting thing is, just to go back to kind of the split between the two divisions, because it has been fairly stable for several years now. Maybe people a few years ago would have expected a bigger shift by now. Yeah. But they do appear to be shifting some, you know, spending or at least some focus from, you know, the I don't want to say legacy, but, you know, the traditional division towards the FCS division now as well, which suggests that maybe they see a kind of inflection point approaching.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, these things aren't achieved overnight, are they? Because, I mean, there's still sort of fairly large volumes of internal combustion-powered vehicles in the Chinese market too. So, but over time, you know, that summation will probably hold true, I would imagine.
The other thing I think you flagged was the, you know, the capital allocation policy. I mean, they've, you know, the shares, we should maybe have said at the top, you know, rallied pretty strongly on these figures earlier this week, in fact, sorry, because of the way it's set out, you know, what it plans to do in terms of dividend, but also buyback. And it's interesting that the company's doing this at the same time. You know, it does have a decent debt pile too. So I think you kind of flagged that as something to watch.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we've seen there's been no shortage of buybacks in this current reporting season too. You know, we've seen some fairly hefty ones, predictably, I guess, from resource companies as well. But TI's joined the party on this. You know, you make the point as well that it does have a fair bit of cash on the books at the moment, but it's got a hefty debt pile. But management took the decision to review the capital allocation policy and came up with the aim of optimizing shareholder value. I mean, I've always been a little bit circumspect with buybacks concerned, because I sometimes wonder whether decision-making related to it is skewed by incentives. I'm not suggesting for a moment this is the case with TI Fluids, but, you know, director's sort of compensation is sometimes linked to, quite often linked to earnings multiples. And of course, if you reduce the number of shares over time, then these will be bumped up artificially in a sense. And another thing as well, it's, you know, 40 million euros isn't chicken feed for a company of that size. And you kind of wonder where the funds weren't prioritized to develop the business further. In fact, I think the CapEx guidance remained unchanged for this year too. And you know, you always wonder, hasn't management got anything better to do with the cash? In terms of the resource companies, you can understand that, because it effectively, a lot of those just stand, the main attractions for investors are the distributions. But with TI, it'd be interesting to drill down a little bit deeper in there. But there we have it. That's just me being a cynic.
Yeah, but I think they are, you know, in TI's case, they are also looking at acquisitions, bolt-on acquisitions, which, again, they've spoken about for a while. They haven't really done any for a while, but yeah, it sounds like some more noises there. So you know, clearly they do have, you know, some cash on hand for that. You know, some, I think when you look at debt to EBITDA, it's not too bad at the moment, and they have paid down some debt, some credit lines in the period.
Yeah, if I was taking anything away from the results, it would be that the improvement in the underlying margin, because I think that's something they have been targeting too. Mm. So it'll be interesting to see what happens over the second half of the year, particularly if I suspect that the Chinese contribution will be larger, even though there's some existing doubts about growth rates in China.
Yeah, and on the buybacks point, you make a good point more broadly there. I think, you know, that there are a lot of companies doing it this reporting season, or this year in particular.
Yeah.
A classic sign of, I suppose, management confidence, i.e., you know, you want to do a buyback if you believe your share price is underpriced. Hopefully it doesn't prove a sign of overconfidence. I mean, ideally you would see, I always think, you know, management buying in more themselves at the same time, but I think quite often you see buybacks come as a substitute for management purposes sometimes, don't they? But management purchases, that is. Anyway,
I mean, this is an endless debate, this one on buybacks, you know.
Yeah, we could spend the rest of the show discussing them, but we won't. We will move on now to our cover story this week, which is, again, looking at you know, payments to shareholders in many ways, looking at income investing. And Dave, you wrote the piece, and very much in the context of the fact that, as we said at the top, you know, risk-free rates, bond yields have risen considerably, as you'd expect, given what's happened to base rates over the past 18 months. So there are now, you know, more options out there for income investors. And can you say a bit more about, I suppose, how you approach this conundrum, if you want to call it that, of, you know, where to look for income?
Yeah, I mean, it could be a conundrum, could be an opportunity, depending how you look at it. I suppose if you looked back maybe 18 months ago, bond yields were incredibly low, very different times, of course. And if you're an income investor, you're probably going to rely on things like equities, equity income funds, and then also those, what we like to call alternative assets, your you know, infrastructure and so on. But what's happened with bond yields completely resets the kind of income landscape, because finally you look at, as you mentioned, the so-called risk-free rate, what you get from something like a UK government bond, you know, something you wouldn't expect to kind of a government's default on. You're getting, you know, more than 4% yield now. So it's, looking at it, I suppose, on a positive note, it's simply very easy to get kind of seemingly safe yields. And that means that it's kind of easier to construct an income portfolio. But I suppose the conundrum is, where do you stick your money? How much do you kind of pile into bonds? And, you know, what does that mean for your overall investments?
So we've certainly seen this year, when you look at the statistics, you know, a decent amount of money coming out of equity funds going into bond funds,
yeah,
which, you know, there is that attraction there, as you outlined. Equally, that is, you know, for people with existing portfolios, that is only ever going to be piecemeal, because I don't think, you know, we're not suggesting, I don't think anyone is going to be suggesting, you know, overhauling an entire portfolio at once in order to take advantage of bonds. Maybe it's more saying at the margin or with new money or something like that.
I think that's it. Yeah, there are a couple of considerations. I mean, one is you mentioned, I suppose, kind of new money versus, I might call it, old money. You know, you don't really want to be selling out of something that is still quite battered after last year. So, for example, if you look at, I mentioned the things like kind of infrastructure, trusts and so on, those will still be kind of nursing some losses. So you don't want to crystallize those losses in order to jump into these very attractive bonds or bond funds. I suppose an interesting kind of point is that you can kind of use bonds on the side, and then you can, that allows you to kind of let the rest of your portfolio work in a sort of more considered and kind of longer term fashion. You know, your equities can gradually kind of compound and build up that income and so on.
Yeah, I mean, that is still a crucial point, isn't it? Which we would be, it would be remiss of us not to mention that, you know, bonds, you know, have the safety in many cases and, you know, good yields now, but equities offer something different insofar as they offer the prospect of dividend growth, you know, i.e. that coupon increasing, the prospect of capital growth, of course, as well, which isn't always there with bonds, although we did see that, you know, over the past decade, but maybe not so much now. So that allows the other part of the portfolio to work harder, as you say. I suppose the other question is, you know, you've got some people commenting on this in the feature about, you know, the split, you know, to put it in very basic terms, again, if you were maybe, you know, starting out now, from an income perspective from scratch, you know, the split between equities and bonds, the traditional, I suppose, 60-40 portfolio for certain. I mean, this is always for certain people, you know, obviously, if you're, you know, early on in your investing life, it would make more sense to have assets that can grow more over the long term. But the 60-40 thing is quite an enduring concept, but maybe that's shifting now as well in terms of 60% equities, 40% bonds might be a bit different now.
Yeah, I think that kind of applied to, and this is again a very subjective term, but the idea of the balanced investor who wants some growth and then some protection and so on. But one interesting kind of figure or proportion that was cited by one person I spoke to for the article was that perhaps if you were the 60-40 advocate in the past, you should now be 60-40, but the other way around. So you have 60 in bonds and 40 in equities, which I think you could argue is pretty punchy. And that also may be kind of a, as you mentioned, a new money thing or a kind of relatively short-term thing. And you may want to kind of adjust your portfolio back over time. But I think it does kind of, that level of kind of bullishness and bonds illustrates how kind of appealing the opportunity is at the minute and just how much easier it is making life for an income investor.
I think that as well, wasn't it? It was from the point of view of a global investor where, you know, in a lot of markets, the yield available on those markets isn't that high, you know, from equities. In the UK, at least, you can still get some pretty good dividend yields. The question being perhaps, you know, how sustainable some of those yields are. When we look at those, you know, I suppose kind of rules of thumb for dividend yield against risk-free rates, do those kind of things still apply? And there's a couple of points mentioned in the piece with regard to some old rules of thumb, which maybe don't apply now. Maybe they do. Who knows?
Yeah. One of the really interesting old rules of thumb that I must admit I was totally unaware of because I suppose it's not been relevant for 10 years or so. But there used to be this idea that if you're looking at, say, a yield on a UK equity or something like that, then the moment it exceeds the so-called risk-free rate, so what you get on maybe a 10-year UK gilt, that's when you start to think, is this a red flag? Is it kind of too high? And is it unsustainable? So I guess, as you say, it's kind of, it'll be interesting to see how that rule holds up. But of course, also, there is the kind of so-called equity risk premium. So you will be expecting something more for kind of taking on that volatility and risk associated with, you know, buying shares or buying equity funds.
Yeah. I mean, to me, that original risk right now, you know, the 10-year gilt's at about 4.4%. So to say anything above that on equities is too good to be true, it seems incredibly overcautious, which I feel confident in saying, because unless every single company ever yielding more than that level cuts their dividend, it won't come back to haunt me. but yeah, you know, you do, you know, as you say, need more compensation for riskier assets. But we talk about, in fact, you know, some of the FTSE 100 companies in the piece, you know, there's plenty now lead which are yielding more than 8%, which is a kind of level, you know, certainly in the 9-10% out there when you look at and you do start to wonder. But that is when the, you know, the stock analysis and the company specific research comes into its own, of course, rather than just taking these things as a whole. One other thing I want to talk about in the piece is you touch on the idea of natural income, which, you know, for a lot of dividend investors is a big thing. But some of the conversations there might be changing now as well.
Yeah. So if you think back to, say, I feel like this was particularly prominent in 2020, there's this big idea that you should be a total return investor rather than going for kind of, you know, as you say, natural income and yield, because if you're looking for natural income, people argue that you're being pushed into kind of X growth or very cyclical sectors that you don't want. So notably in the UK, you're energy majors and so on.
We should say that I suppose the natural income is when you know you don't or try not to touch capital at all and you just survive purely off the, you know, dividends, which might be a natural thing to think about when you think of an income investor. But it's not always that easy.
Yeah, yeah. So the alternative approach was the total return approach. So you perhaps get maybe some income, but also some capital growth. And what you do is you sell down your assets and use that to kind of fund your income. But I suppose that was quite a convincing argument, the total return side, back when, you know, bond yields and so on were quite low. But now things have shifted. Natural income seems a lot more sustainable. It probably seems easier to get something like, say, 4% natural income. And the argument has shifted. Also, I suppose one argument against total return might be that it does invite an element of kind of market timing.
Yeah, you know, with the advantage of the natural income on that side, isn't it, is, you know, you get your quarterly or your interim dividends. You get them at set times. You don't need to sell down at what might prove to be an inopportune time, that kind of thing. As I say, that is our cover story this week, so do look out for that. But let's do a 180 now. You know, income investing is one thing. Growth investing is something entirely different. And when we're looking at smaller portfolios, as we are doing now in the piece written by you, Val, quite often these are going to be starter portfolios or people, you know, just setting out on their investment journey, which would imply, therefore, they have a very long-term time horizon. But whatever reason, you know, whatever time horizon and motivation they have in mind, there are some, you know, tips and rules, if you want to go that far, that can make it easier to get started.
Yeah, I think one of the key things is, you know, when you start at the beginning, you know, you can, you know, you're maybe not always sure about what you want to do with the portfolio. And some people who might also be expert investors, but they might kind of also be running a smaller portfolio on the side. They might sort of think, okay, well, let's get this started and see where it goes a little bit. But that's not necessarily maybe the best approach, because so even if the portfolio is small and it will take you a bit of time to kind of like research it and get it going, and at the beginning, obviously the returns won't be that much. So they will not compensate for that effort you put in at the beginning. As the portfolio grows, then you will get their rewards eventually. So there is, I suppose, a bit of a danger of being cavalier, because the sum is relatively small. And you know, it's okay to keep things quite simple at the beginning, but it sort of doesn't mean you can sort of forget of the basic principles of investing. I think that's the sort of main thing. So, you know, speaking to some people, I think that the main mistakes they were seeing from people managing small portfolios were not thinking as much about asset allocation. So, you know, maybe you have a very kind of long-term perspective, and in that case, just 100% equity is probably fine. But if that's not the case, you still want to think about, you know, like protecting on the downside and sort of just kind of like diversifying the portfolio. So yeah, I think the key principle there is kind of you want to find the balance between the effort you put in and still having a sort of diversified portfolio that works for you.
Yeah. In some ways, I was completely wrong to draw the contrast between income investing and growth in this context, because you're right. You know, that diversification is important depending on the time horizon. And with a small portfolio, you know, big falls can obviously be much more damaging given the amount you're having to start. Cost, obviously, on a related note, is very important too. More so for a small portfolio, you might say, than for any others, really.
Yeah, because, yeah, that's basically because of fixed fees. So, you know, when you have like percentage-based fees, this obviously same impact to whatever the size of the portfolio. But when you have fixed ones, they will impact a small portfolio disproportionately. And that's usually tends to be trading fees on, you know, single companies' shares, ETFs and investment trusts, just because that's the way platforms tend to charge. And so basically that means that if you have that kind of portfolio, your potential mistakes or even just like changing your mind or trying to, you know, time a call in some way, it gets proportionally much more expensive. And so you kind of need to think ahead a little bit and kind of get into that mindset that if you want to make a change to your portfolio, it's going to potentially make quite a big dent into your returns. Because, I mean, it obviously depends on the platforms, but some platforms do have pretty pricey trading fees. So that means, you know, you have a 10K portfolio, you do maybe 4 trades a year, and that's already half a percentage point of your portfolio gone just because of those 4 trades. So it kind of adds up very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the key structural things, I think, that people probably don't realize, is that if you're buying, as you say, ETFs, shares, investment trusts on platforms, you should be aware that certainly on the major platforms, there are, you know, alternatives available that can solve this problem. But on those major platforms, you have trading fees that, as you say, can eat into the returns. Whereas with an open-ended fund, most the big platforms now don't charge you to buy and sell those funds. So that is a key difference when you, you know, if you have a particularly small portfolio.
Yeah. And also there's this idea, which is tends to be true in general, that funds are more expensive to kind of hold on most platforms. And that is true if you have a bigger portfolio or a medium-sized portfolio, because with shares, usually the platform fee is capped to a certain point. Mm. But then obviously, if your portfolio is not big enough to reach the cap anyway, holding funds or holding shares or trusts will not really make a difference in terms of the platform fee either.
Yeah. Those annual costs.
What
about you know, the platforms in general? We'll come back to the kind of diversification asset allocation in a minute, but since we're on the subject of platforms, you know, their fees do differ to varying degrees. We go through all this in the piece. We have some, you know, good information and tables in there, as you'd expect. But what kind of things should other things should people watch for in terms of platform charges, what they should be looking for? Maybe I'm thinking particularly here in terms of fixed fees, which we mentioned as well to begin with.
So as we were saying, the trading fees, it's the main thing. So if you want kind of like the freedom to trade a bit more often, and you're not, you know, maybe you're a quite expert investor, or you're not very worried about having a super top quality service, or you don't need funds, at that point you can maybe have a look at the kind of like trading only platforms, which compared to the, you know, the mainstream ones, they sort of take more the approach where trading is either free or quite cheap. And then, you know, you get less kind of choice of funds, for example. So that's one of the things you can do. And then more in general, you kind of want to have a look at, you know, any other fixed fees you might have, because there is a couple of platforms that actually do charge fixed fees, not just on trading, but just in terms of platform costs. And there are obviously, I mean, the obvious one is Interactive Investor, whose pitch was always from the beginning, we're going to charge you with like a fixed fee, so you know what you will pay. And then obviously you get rewarded as your portfolio grows, because it gets less and less expensive very quickly. So, you know, that's certainly one thing to think about, that those kind of platforms get very cheap when your portfolio is big and are a bit more pricey at the beginning.
Yeah, I think I on that note, well, I know that they are changing their prices slightly, aren't they, next month, albeit that doesn't really offset the point you make about fixed fees. You know, that is still a more expensive option for a starter investor or someone with a small portfolio. But let's turn to the, I suppose, the asset allocation again. One question that comes up a lot, you know, whether you've got a small portfolio or otherwise, is, you know, balancing between the need to diversify and having too many holdings. You know, how does that kind of manifest, play out with small portfolios in particular?
Yeah, it's very tricky, isn't it? I think especially if you use, like you're used to investing in companies, then diversifying adequately with a small sum gets a bit complicated. So I think in general, you know, you want to think about the usual things. So you want to diversify from, well, an asset point of view, back to the point on asset allocation that we made at the beginning, and then geography and sectors. And then the way, let's say the easier way to do this rather than with companies is with using either funds or ETFs or investment trusts. And then potentially, so, you know, you're trying to basically balance not having too many holdings and also not making it too pricey or too difficult to keep track of, because again, the portfolio is small. So it might be worth, you know, going passive for a chunk of the portfolio, because then, you know, you both reduce the costs, but also you kind of like have less risk of underperforming the market because you're tracking it. So that's also a point. And then if you want to diversify, for example, within alternatives or with investment trusts, you want to, well, to be fair, with funds as well, you want to check exactly what those funds are holding, because, you know, you might think you have two holdings that are very different and you're getting like different exposure to different things. But actually, you might not be doing that. You might be having two funds that bet on the same sectors or companies.
I know this is a point that Dave often makes about, you know, US funds and global funds, for example, you know, the fact that a lot of those global funds are, you know, majority US shares anyway, so you can easily double up that way, for example. On which note, I mean, the other aspect to talk about with diversification and with the kind of funds you own and how many funds you own, is there are, you know, you can, if you're starting out as well, in some ways, just put it all in one fund, whether that be, you know, there are a couple of different ways of doing that, really.
I mean, you can just go with a global tracker and just be done with it, and that's the easy way. Or you can go with like a multi-asset fund or a fund of funds, with the sort of caveat that it can get a bit more expensive. So, you know, you've got to think about whether that's worth it for you. And then I think one thing we mentioned in the piece, which is basically what I was saying, is that if you do go active, you don't want to hold just one fund, because then the risk of underperformance you're exposed to is quite high, because if that fund doesn't go right, then the whole portfolio is impacted.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the lesson from, you know, recent history as well with people starting out, certainly with investing, and they probably don't have a portfolio, but they might have, you know, some risky assets or some cryptocurrencies or something, is that, you know, if you're betting it all on one particular thing, then it can go very wrong very quickly. So there's a lot of information in the piece, you know, approaching it from all different kinds of angles, you know, whatever your the reason you're starting this small portfolio. That's in the magazine this week. It's also online, so do have a look out for that. We've run out of time, though, today, unfortunately. So thank you very much to Val, to Dave, and to Mark, and to you for listening. We'll be back next week with another Companies and Markets show.